No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the discussion at 888-627-6008, or you can go to the chat box on the BBS Radio website and send in a question if you like. We have a very special guest tonight. First, let me say hello to my co-host, Maria. Maria, how are you, and how's life in California?
Life in California, we're under kind of lockdown again. We're back right where we were at the beginning of March, unfortunately. So here we go again. We'll try it this time.
Yeah. Isn't it something?
Yeah.
And one of those people that we lost, although this was not to COVID-19, it was to cancer. One of the people that we lost this week was an icon in the civil rights movement, Congressman John Lewis from Georgia, who, as you may know, bled on the Pettus Bridge with Dr. King, stood before a crowd of hundreds of thousands of people at 23 years old and addressed them at the March on Washington, and he spent his entire life as in the civil rights movement, and he was an icon. But I want to tell you a little story about the last time I saw John Lewis. I was up on the Hill, Maria. I was actually there to meet with a Republican congressman named Don Young from Alaska. And we went into this meeting. We had a great meeting with Congressman Young. And on the way out of the building, we passed Lewis's office. And our intern, who was a kid from Georgia Tech, said, "Oh, that's my congressman, John Lewis." And my assistant, Karen, said, "Well, you want to go in and say hello?" And Teddy was like, "Oh, I don't know." And she's like, "Yeah, just go in and they'll tell him that you came by to say hello. He'll like that." And so we went in and we told the receptionist who Teddy was. And she said, "Well, wait a second. I think he's here." And Lewis came out. John Lewis came out, took us into his inner office and sat there for 20 minutes. Wow. Talking to Teddy. Didn't say one thing about himself. All he wanted to do was know where Teddy was going to school, what his ambition was, how he felt about Georgia Tech, did he like being in Washington. He wanted to know all about Teddy. And he encouraged Teddy, of course, to continue his education and to do great things in the world. And you know what? I think it's times like that that you see the real character of a person. Mm-hmm. When there's nothing in it for them. When there's no, you know, there was nothing in this for him. There were no TV cameras. There were
exactly. It wasn't just a photo op.
Right. It wasn't a photo op. It was just him and this kid. And you could tell by the way he talked to him that he felt as an elder statesman that it was his responsibility to inspire young people. And God bless him. That's what we hope all our leaders will do. He was a real leader, and we really will miss him.
Absolutely.
And all that being said, now let's introduce you to another great guy that I happened to meet along the trail. His name is Rodney Robinson. And last year, he was National Teacher of the Year. He is a 19-year teaching veteran who became a teacher to honor his mother, who struggled to receive an education after being denied as a child due to segregation and poverty in rural Virginia. In 2015, he started teaching at an education center inside the Richmond Juvenile Detention Center. In an effort to better understand the school-to-prison pipeline, I met him in Austin, Texas. I heard him speak. He's a remarkable speaker. I can see why he was Teacher of the Year. Everybody there at the dinner that I went to really responded to him. So we're so happy to have Teacher of the Year Rodney Robinson with us tonight. Welcome to the show, Rodney.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. It really is an honor to be on your show. I remember Austin as well. It was in the middle of a history conference, so it was a really good time in Austin, Texas.
It really was. But you were the surprise, Rodney. Let me just tell you that, because I come to so many of these dinners and I end up falling asleep halfway through the keynote speech, you know, because I've been running around all day at one of these conferences, you know, as an old guy. But you lit the place on fire, and everybody thought you were wonderful. So thanks for being with us. And let me ask you my first question. What are you going to do this fall? My wife is a school librarian. She's also in Virginia. She has no idea at this point what her school system, the Fairfax County school system, which I think is the largest one in the state, is going to do.
Yeah.
So what do you know about what you're going to do, and what do you want to do in the fall?
Oh, well, first of all, no question, Fairfax is the largest in the state. Fairfax has 20% of all students in the state of Virginia. So it is by far the largest school district in the state of Virginia. But luckily, our school division in Richmond, they voted the other night and they were going to be fully virtual for the first semester. So that means until February, all students will be learning online or through remote learning, which, you know, I'm really happy about, because number one, it puts the safety of our students and teachers in our community first. And that's really what's important right now. We can't afford to lose another single life to coronavirus. And as long as we keep schools closed, we can guarantee that will minimize the effect that it's having on the community of Richmond. So we're really, really excited that our school division has been a leader and decided to do this. Now, with this, of course, comes a lot of work right now. We're trying to make sure every student has a device, a technology device, a Chromebook or a laptop. Then we have to make sure they all have internet access, and they're ensuring that all teachers are trained on how to properly administer lessons remotely. But then we're also making sure that we're serving the needs of our most vulnerable students, those that are, you know, in exceptional education, and that we're following what their IEP says. And then there's my students in a lockdown facility. And so just last week, we had a meeting with everyone involved, whether it's school, the Department of Juvenile Justice officials, staff, and we just had one big meeting of how is this going to work? What can we do to make this work? And luckily, you know, everybody was on the same page, because at our facility, we make sure that we put students first. Because I often say, you know, if you want a second chance at life, the best way to take advantage of that second chance is a quality education. And so I'm really, really happy that our district is going that way. Now, me personally, of course, I'll be teaching virtually, but I'm also I'm going back to school in the fall to get my EDD, my doctorate in education. And I'm really looking forward to doing the work of recruiting more teachers of color into the classroom. As you know, we only have 50% of our students are students of color, while 80% of the teachers are white. And so it's really a disproportionate thing, and a lot of bad things happen, misunderstanding of cultures, the achievement gap. So I really want to dive deep into the work of recruiting and retaining more teachers of color in the classroom. And so, you know, I'm going to use this time to just take full advantage of all the resources, but most importantly, I just want to make sure my students have what they need to be successful.
That's great. Maria, do you have a question? I don't want to monopolize.
Sure do.
I know you do.
Rodney, I can't speak enough to your ambition, having started on my PhD 20 years ahead of you. I mean, 20 years older than you. It's a big nut in front of you that I'm in the dissertation process now. But will be so valuable for you and your career and ultimately your students with that extra education that you're asking of yourself, not to mention you're walking the walk and talking the talk, which is also you're leading by example. Yeah. So tell me, because the detention center, they're compelled to be there, will you be on a monitor in front of them, i.e. in a classroom, or will they be on their separate devices?
Well, we have programs. We already have a virtual program as a part of our school lesson where the kids can take classes online. And so what we're doing is ensuring that, A, they're getting supplemental materials to go with the online learning program we already have, and then we're making sure that detention staff knows how to monitor. Sort of like, because they're the parents in a sense, just like parents at home have to learn how to monitor their children through virtual learning. We have to make sure that detention staff or the counselors and the guards know how to work the system. And so we're going to do some trainings with them, and we're going to make sure that they understand how the virtual program works. And then they're going to be our contact, our go-between with the students. So if students need more work or less work, it's up to us to work with them to make sure that they have what they need. And then we monitor the program. We can add, take away assignments. And so it's really we're in a good situation at our facility. I can't speak that to all detention facilities in the United States, but we emphasize the education at our facility. So I'm really proud of the staff for coming together and working out a plan, because we really understand the importance of education for our students. And I often tell them that's the one thing that they cannot take away from you. Is that diploma, that education, your interest. And so even, you know, once you leave us, hopefully if you don't come back, but even if you come back, they can't take that education from you. Just understand that, and that by getting the education, you'll be a better person.
And you teach grades 6 through 12 at the detention center, correct?
Yes.
That's starting so young.
Honestly, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Honestly, I don't like the fact when we get kids. I mean, the facility runs from ages 12 to 19. I hate when we get kids that young, you know, but if they come to us, my job as an educator is just to teach. You know, we really do a lot of advocating.
Rodden, how does the 12-year-old get in jail?
Usually if you're 12 and you've done something, it's usually something of a serious nature. You know, if you're under 12, there's all sorts of programs and things to keep you out. But every now and then we get someone who's done something that had a high level of violence in it. And usually they're not there long. It's really just, we're going to keep you here, but usually 12-year-olds are gone in a matter of time. But unfortunately, you do have some that have committed serious crimes and are deemed dangerous to the community, and they're not allowed to go. But really it's a chance for us to provide that healing. Because if you're a 12-year-old and you're committing, 12 years old and you're committing some sort of violent crime, there's a lot of trauma and hurt inside that young man or young woman. And so we really try to use a whole child approach and try to encompass and heal this child. And then once they leave, you try to put them in a position to where they don't come back. And one good thing is when our 12th graders come to us, it allows for that quick, immediate intervention, you know, and that usually works. You know, that usually gets them on the right track. However, once the kid is a little older, 15, 16, there's a lot more work to be done to get that intervention, to get them back on the right track. So I hate the fact that we get them, but it also provides an opportunity for us to intervene and change their life at a much younger age.
Yeah, you know, I want to talk to you a second about that comment that you made about second chances, because, Rodney, I lost both my parents as a teenager. I acted out. I dropped out of school. I have never finished high school. I have a general equivalency diploma, but I also have a master's degree, and that certainly changed my life. having that second chance. And the second chance came by me going to school. You know, when I was a high school dropout, I was a delinquent. When I got my master's degree, I was a citizen. You know, I was just like everybody else. And by the way, my brother has a doctorate in education, so keep on going for that EED. He became president of a college with his. But, but you know, I it's all about giving that second chance. And, you know, if for me, the reason I got it, to make a long story short, is I got to go on this trip that my sister helped me organize. My sister, the first person in my family to go to college, helped me organize, where I stayed on 20 college campuses around the United States. And when I got back, all I wanted to do was go to college. So I got my equivalency diploma. I had. So how do we do that with these kids? How do we show them? Because that's what my sister did for me. She showed me that there was a great big world out there that I didn't even know about, that was so much better than the world that I had put myself in. How do we do that, especially with distance learning? How do we expose kids to, you know, the potential that they waste by not getting an education?
Well, one thing we do at our facility is that we constantly try to influence them with good role models, but not just good role models, relatable role models, meaning people from the community who they know, people who've grown up, people who were in our detention center or in jail but have gone on to do great things in life. And that's really what it's all about. We bring in once a month at our facility, we have motivational assemblies. And with that motivational assemblies are, we bring in people from the arts community, we bring in business people, we bring in anyone who can motivate our students. But in order to motivate our students, you have to understand our students. And so we make sure that there are people from the community who can come in, can talk about the mistakes they made in life, how they corrected their life, and how they moved on. And then on top of that, we don't just talk about college, you know. We actually bring in the recruiters, the presidents of the local colleges. We bring in some of the college students. We bring in the choirs from some of these colleges to perform for them. We kind of show them that other side that they aren't used to. And some of our students earn the right to go on field trips. And when they get that right, we take them to college. We take them to college days. We take them to football games and basketball games and things like that, because we want you to understand that college is still an option. And even something as small as in our facility, one thing we've done is every window in the school, we put a college banner on. And so that way, if a kid is looking out of a window and daydreaming like kids, you know, sometimes do, we want you to still think that college is a possibility. And so we really try to show them. We connect them to community members, organizations. If you have an interest, we tell them, if you have an interest, it's our job to build upon that interest. I mean, we had one kid, unfortunately, he was there for stealing dogs, you know, and which is, the breeding business can be a lot of money. And so, because he loved animals. So we connected him with the SPCA. And so from that, he got out and did his volunteering. He had a business where he walks dogs, he grooms dogs, and he takes care of them, and he makes more money than I do as a teacher. And so that's what I mean about putting them to what they're interested in, provide them the education that can support their dreams. And we go out of our way at our school to ensure that if you have a dream, we're going to do what we can to help you achieve that dream.
Well, you know,
Michael, Rodney has his own personal story that I think it's not just anecdotal, Rodney, about what your dad had you do to motivate you to go to college.
Oh, yeah, that was eighth grade. I'll never forget this. I had a bad experience my first time at college. I took a class at this community college. I think it was an oceanography class my eighth grade year, you know, in between high school and college. And I had a really bad experience, unfortunately, because there was a lot of race. I was the only black kid in the class. I wasn't accepted. I was just, you know, discriminated against by the teacher. And so I remember going home and saying, you know what, Dad, college isn't for me. And so I remember my dad telling me the next morning, like, okay, since, you know, college isn't for you, you got to go to work. You know, start getting used to the world of work. And he sent me out to work on a farm. And I'll never forget, man, that was about 100 degrees in the middle of a field. I'm bailing hay. It was just a horrible, horrible hot experience. And I remember, I don't know if you remember those early 90s Ernest movies. You know, Ernest Saves Christmas, Ernest does all this. But they were like maybe 90 minutes total, those movies. I remember when I left to go to work, my cousin was watching one of those movies. And when I came back, that same movie was still on. And I just told my dad when I got back in the house, like, you know what, I think I'm going to go to college. This farm life and this sort of thing isn't for me, you know. Yeah. But that was just my dad's way of showing he knew me. He knew that that type of life I wasn't into. And that was really one of the few options you had growing up in rural Virginia. And so he kind of let me know that college is where you need to be. And that really was a life-changing moment and really got me more focused on my future, because I did not want to be lifting bales of hay for the rest of my life.
Nice.
Well, very, you know, nice. What? This is amazing. And maybe your dad knew my sister, but she used the same approach. I had a job when I was in high school that I loved, and I worked 35 hours a week at it because we were poor. And on the day I dropped out of high school, a few days later, I went to work, and they fired me. And they fired me because they said my sister, who was my legal guardian, had called and threatened to sue them if they didn't fire me. And when I got home, I said to my sister, "What did you do?" And she said, "Well, honey, if you're not going to go to school, you need a full-time job." And I said, "Well, I'll never forget this. I said, well, I have a 35-hour week job." And she said, "Oh, honey, you should have stayed in school, because then you would know that a full-time job is 40 hours a week, and 40 hours is more than 35. And guess what job I got, Rodney? I became a ditch digger. I was a construction laborer, you know, and the same thing. I was digging ditches. I was doing horrible work. And I saw people there. I was only 16, but I saw people there in their 40s. And I thought to myself, I bet when they were 16, they didn't think they'd be doing this their whole lives either. So the same motivation. I got out there. I said, oh, my God. And you're so brilliant to put up the as somebody who majored in daydreaming in high school, you're so brilliant to put up the banners. And that was another thing my sister did. When she sent me on the trip, when I went on this trip around the colleges, what she did, I wanted to go around the United States. She gave me my high school yearbook and told me to stay with, to save money, stay with kids I knew that were going to different colleges around the United States, which is what I did. But they were my peers, and I saw them doing it. And that, and you're so right. Once you see them doing it, you go, hey, these are my friends. These are people I know. These are people from my community. Damn it, if they can do it, I can do it too. So, so you know, you're brilliant at that. And we really, you know, I really think that you're doing amazing things by doing this way. Let me ask you, how about the Black Lives Matter movement? We see you're a social studies teacher, are you not, Rodney?
Yes.
So, what do you think of this new movement, which seems to me to be making great progress? I mean, you know, I guess we'll wait to see if we really make systemic changes that will change the future for these people. But right now, things like NASCAR and Mississippi taking down the Stars and Bars and the Redskins changing their name. And I just heard that the Marine Corps got their first woman African-American fighter pilot. And what other institution did I one of the military academies got their first Black commandant. It seems things are changing. Do you think you're changing? And how do you think young people feel about this? What kind of feedback are you getting?
Well, the good news is, you know, one of the things that I really enjoyed is just seeing so many of my students, you know, current, you know, I'm former students who, you know, I taught comprehensive high school before I moved to the detention center. seeing so many of them out at, you know, protesting, you know, and then also seeing them take control of the protests. I've seen videos where the protests were getting out of hand, and I saw some of my, literally saw some of my former students pull those people to the side and say, this is not what it's about, you know, and those types of things as a social studies teacher, I mean, it just warmed my heart because I always tell my students to be the change that you want to see. And to see them taking those lessons at heart and out in the streets making a difference, it just, that was just, as a teacher, I mean, come on, that was just some of the greatest, one of the greatest moments of my life, to see my students leading these protests. And so that really made me feel good. But as far as what's going on, I think it's a lot of momentum right now, you know, because one thing, the country is actually open to having conversations more so than ever before. You know, because, you know, unfortunately, that George Floyd video was probably one of the most violent things anyone will ever see in their life. And so when you see that type of violence, not only is it traumatizing, but it really makes you question everything that led up to that. And with that, you had to question the entire system. And so what we're seeing now is that people are starting to say, hey, this isn't right. We're starting to see black people and a lot of white people. This is a multiracial movement. And so that's what's really, really inspiring. And even though, you know, in Richmond itself, I mean, we had Monument Avenue, which was a whole avenue dedicated to Confederate statues. And we just, within the month, all that's down. You know, all of that came down. But it's good to say, okay, that's good, but that's just the start to what we want. And so now I see the even though we've taken down those symbols, the movement is still going. They're starting to have these conversations about defunding the police. What does that look like? What does the civilian review board look like? Even though I'm mayor, I'm on a committee in Richmond to reimagine public safety. What is public safety? What has it looked like in the past, and what will it look like in the future? And so we're talking about some of the things that the police department can do, you know. And so we're having conversations that have never taken place. And even in education, I'm going to push that we start having some serious conversations. Unfortunately, in education right now, everyone's so focused on the pandemic because we're dealing with that and how can we ensure kids get an education. But even in education, we got a lot of work to do, especially when it comes to, you know, recruiting teachers of color, making sure that students of color have the same achievement as, you know, white students, closing that achievement gap. We need to also look at why black students being suspended at a higher rate than white students. And so these are conversations that people are finally open to having, and that's the key. And what I'm seeing is an energy that is not dying. You know, we take down the statues, we take down the flag, and all that's good, but there are a lot more pressing things that have a daily effect on us than the statue, and we're really going to keep going and pushing until we get those issues addressed. And I'm really, really excited to see our young people step up to the plate and really, really have these meaningful conversations and not back down when getting told no.
Me too. Maria?
I want to say that we've kind of just glossed over a little bit about what it means to get the National Teacher of the Year Award, because you had a lot of competition. And do you want to give a summary of it to our listeners so they can put it into perspective about what it means that you actually got that distinction?
Well, there, of course, just overall, there are 3.5 million teachers in the United States, public school teachers. And then, you know, each state has its own process of selecting a state teacher of the year. And Virginia is sort of like a, it's like a moving on. First you win your district, then you win your region, and then I won state teacher of the year in the state of Virginia. Then it came to the 57 state teachers of the year in territories all submitted applications, and from those applications there was a final four chosen. That was myself, Danielle Rio from Alaska, Donna Grundle from Oklahoma, and Kelly Harper from D.C., Washington, D.C. We were all finalists, and then I joked, but we really had like a two-day bachelor-style competition that included media interviews, meet with politicians, keynotes, question interviews from panelists, and it was really intense. I tell people that all the time. That was just really intense.
You, you have to submit essays too, right?
Yes, that was part. Yeah, that was part of the national application where we had to submit those essays, and then you were chosen from those us final four, and then from the final four, you know, I was chosen as National Teacher of the Year. But I have to say, it's not, you're not chosen like a winner. It's sort of like you're the representation of all the teachers, because I'm not going to lie, that 57 State Teachers of the Year cohort that we had in 2019, there's some outstanding people in that group. And it was like, I'm so glad I wasn't the person who had to choose the 2020, because I know every teacher, when you get to that level, it's just so phenomenal. Everybody has stories. Everybody has good work they do, and they're all so passionate about children. And that's what this thing is all about, is being passionate about children and getting them the tools they need to be successful. And so once I won for a year, I got a year sabbatical out of the classroom, and I just spent the year just going around the country advocating for education. You know, and my platform, like I said, was, of course, was three things: economic equity, making sure all students get what they need when they need them, because, I mean, the inequities that exist in this country between, you know, I wouldn't even say states. You can go from one locality in Virginia to the next locality and see vast inequities and resources and things they have. And so I want to make sure all students have good resources, and that comes from economic equity. Earlier I talked about cultural equity, where I wanted to make sure that all students have teachers who look like them or who appreciate them and who come from the same culture as them. And so when I talk about cultural equity, people often say it's a black and white thing, but it's so much more than that. It's an LGBTQ thing. It's a socioeconomic thing. It's having teachers who come from the same culture as our students. And that's really important that all students get that. And lastly, of course, because I work in a juvenile detention center, I want to end the school-to-prison pipeline. And so those have been my three main messages as I've toured the country and inspiring people and having conversations with politicians, policymakers, and all colleges and universities of how can we improve the field of education. And unfortunately, COVID cut my year short. You know, I stopped traveling in March. And, you know, for ever since then, I've been home doing virtual. But still, it's about getting that message out and advocating for what those kids need and what my kids need. Because it's really important that I had used this platform for two reasons. One is, when we talk about education, people rarely talk about students in alternative settings. And so I felt that it was my job to represent those students in group homes, detention facilities, alternative schools, the kids that are sort of forgotten about when we talk about education. I wanted to make sure that all decisions that affect them are solid decisions. And so that's really been important. And then two, I represent black male educators. We're only 2% of the field. And it's rare that we get the mic to talk about the need in education. As a matter of fact, I'm only the third black male to win National Teacher of the Year and the first one in over 30 years. And so it's been really important that I use this platform to advocate for the needs of black male teachers and teachers of color to make sure that we're fairly respected and we get what we deserve in educational conversation. And so I've just spent the year going around the country speaking, meeting great people like Senator Brown, and just having really a good time, you know, besides the travel. The travel was exhausting, I'm not going to lie. You know, when you're stuck in Atlanta's airport at 4 in the morning and you have to be in, you know, Minneapolis by 9 o'clock to give a speech, those nights were pretty terrible. But at the same time, it was all an opportunity, a great opportunity to just spread the word about what all kids need to be successful. And I'm truly appreciative for this life-changing moment. You know, it's really life-changing to see education from a national perspective.
Well, and to give our listeners some perspective, this award has been around since 1952, so that's almost 70 years. So, and you're only the third black male. That's a long time with not very much recognition. And one more question, Michael. Talk to us about receiving the award at the White House, and you can make this political or not, and we won't be offended if you do make it political, because that involved meeting President Trump.
Well, it was really interesting because, for one, I was the first to not be given the award by the president. You know, I got my award from Betsy DeVos, Secretary of Education. And so that in itself was just a very political moment. You know, the fact that, A, I was a black man and the president of the United States, you know, refusing to give me my award. And so that itself created a lot of controversy when it happened. However, you know, we had the ceremony it wasn't even at the White House. It was at the executive building that's on the White House grounds. And so that's what we were told, that we were going to have it. And then, of course, I was told by the U.S. Department of Education I couldn't give my speech, my acceptance speech, because it was a little critical of some policies. It, you know, not of individual people, just critical of policies. But I felt like I was advocating for students. And then, you know, of course, I got the award. I gave my speech because Betsy DeVos asked me if I wanted to say a few words. And, of course, I used that opportunity. So, you know, every time I get an opportunity to talk about my kids, I'm going to talk about my kids. So I gave that speech, and then they told us all to put down all of our cell phones, and they walked us over to the White House to meet President Trump. And to me, it wasn't even about Trump. To me, I tell people all the time, my enslaved ancestors built the White House. And so I want the opportunity to go into the house that they built. You know, there have been 45 presidents in that place, some good, some bad. But that White House is still standing, and that was built by my people. And so it was never about President Trump to go into the Oval Office and all. It was just a moment of honoring my ancestors and getting in there and getting caught up in the history and thinking about what my people went through to build this. And here I am, a black man, standing in this White House. It was a very emotional moment. I'm not going to lie. It was just extremely emotional for me, to the point where I kind of blocked out everything else that was going on, you know. And then, you know, I got caught up in the emotion of I'm in the place that my people built. And so it was really never about President Trump. You know, as much as media and other people tried to make it about President Trump, it was about me getting my rightful place to stand in a home that my ancestors built. And so that was really, really humbling moment. You know, and I stayed out of the politics of it all during the time period, because I know if I make it about Trump, then it takes away from the message of my students. And so I never made it about Trump. I never made it about politics. I always made it about my students and doing what is best and representing them. And so, you know, everyone else tried to spin it and make it things. And, you know, since it's been over, I've been talking about this experience a little more, you know, but at the time it was all about my students. I'm going to show them that in life, even if you disagree with people, sometimes if you have something in common, let's work on it. And I felt that the Department of Education was doing a good job with, you know, prisoner education. And so that was a common area that we could talk about. And so whenever something benefits them, I'm going to sit down and have that conversation that benefits them. And so in the end, you know, everyone tried to make it political, you know, and it wasn't political, but at the moment, it was not political. It was about doing what's best for my students.
Well, you know, I don't know if you remember this, but in Austin, after your speech, I offered to be your volunteer as your campaign manager when you ran for governor. I want you to know that offer still stands, with the caveat that free advice is worth what you pay for it. But let me ask you, that speech that you gave was so inspirational. And correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't you talk about meeting John Lewis? Wasn't that
the nexus of that speech? Yes, I remember. It was funny because the Council of Chief State Schools Officers, which runs the Teacher of the Year program, when I first won, we were just having a conversation. They asked me, who would you like to meet before this year is over? You know, who's your dream person to meet? And first thing out of my mouth was John Lewis. I want to meet John Lewis. You know, and then, of course, I like to meet Obama. You know, then I got into the celebrity thing. But to me, it was all about John Lewis, you know, because of what he's done for America. And it's funny because I got to speak to the House Democratic Caucus. That was a unique thing. I was the first Teacher of the Year to be allowed to speak to the entire House of Representatives. Of course, you know how partisan things can get in Washington. They invited the Republican Caucus that they didn't show, as you know. But I got a chance to speak to the entire House Democratic Caucus. Of course, that's because Johanna Hayes made that request, because she's trying to advocate for more teacher voice in the Congress. And I got to tell John Lewis the story of when I first met him. I first heard him speak. And it was 2008. We were on, every year, you know, of course, in D.C., they have the Congressional Black Caucus Conference in D.C. And every year, even when I taught at Comprehensive High School, because it's a free conference, I just get a bus. We get a bus, and we bring our kids up and let them enjoy the day, meet all the speakers, and have a good time. And I remember in 2008, I took my kids. I was telling John Lewis the story. We got there, and I saw his name speaking. And I was like, oh, my God, kids, John Lewis is leading a panel. Let's go. And so, you know, we're rushing through the Washington, D.C. Convention Center. You know, and I'm literally, like, in a full sprint because I want to see John Lewis. We got to get front row to see John Lewis. And so I'm running through the thing. The kids are trying to keep up with me. I bumped into Al Sharpton, knocked him down, which is kind of funny. You know, and then I get to the room where the speech is occurring. You know, we're early because I'm excited. I want front row. And I turn around, there are no kids behind me. And so I'm like, I've lost 30 kids in Washington, D.C. And you guys know how big that convention center is.
Yes.
It's like,
yes.
I don't know where they are. So I'm doubling back, running through the convention center, wondering what's going on. And so I'm on the upper level, and I look down, and I recognize a coat that one of my kids has on. And so I see all of my kids crowded in the corner. And so I'm like, what are they doing? You know, and then, you know, so I'm trying to rush down to get to them. And then by the time I get there, not only my kids, it's about another 30 kids all huddled in the corner. So I'm thinking, oh, my God, all the way up here on the bus, all they talked about was Barack Obama. So is Barack Obama here? Why are they over in the corner like that? And so I get into the corner. And I fight my way through the kids, and all 60 kids are over there huddled around a payphone. And I mean, they're like, how does this work? What are you doing?
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm sitting there like, come on, kids. John Lewis, Selma, Civil Rights, Great American, let's go. Yeah. Can you put money in it? What are you doing? So I put a quarter in it, and we called the nicest lady ever in Washington, D.C., and she talked to my kids for a few minutes. And so I was like, okay, now let's go. So then by the time we get back to the room, it's almost packed. We're stuck all the way in the back. And I'm livid. I'm pissed at my kids because we're now in the back of this room. And so, but they got a chance to see John Lewis and hear him speak. And so I told John Lewis that day, I was like, you know what, for my kids, you're really their biggest hero, but just understand that you're only a little bit more important than a payphone. And so just had this great laugh, and he took pictures of me, and it was just one of the greatest moments of my life, just meeting John Lewis and having that conversation. And, you know, it was just so humbling. And, you know, America really lost an icon. You know, I think we use that term too loosely in America, but John Lewis truly is an American icon. And it's, you know, sad. It's a sad time in America right now. And, you know, unfortunately, he's not going to get the send-off he deserves due to COVID-19. But, you know, once this is over, I really think we need, as a country, maybe next year by this time on the anniversary of his death, we should have a huge, huge, you know, ceremony or celebration to celebrate the life of John Lewis.
That's a great idea.
As well as C.T. Vivian and some of the other leaders we've lost during COVID.
Yes. And you know what? I said in my tweet about John Lewis that maybe it's time to replace some of those Confederate statues with statues of people like him, because he really was. Yeah. He, as you know, because you met him, not only all those things you said about him, but also just a warm, wonderful person on top of all of it. It's just made it amazing. Yeah. And I know how you feel about the payphone, because my kids came to me one day. One of my kids asked me what a monochrome monitor was on a computer, and I said it was like a black and white TV. And he looked at me and said, "What's a black
TV?"
Yeah, he had never. And it dawned on me, he had never seen a black and white TV. I was an adult before I ever bought a color TV. So you know, but you know, that's a payphone. That's great.
So Rodney, you know what's awesome? Like to ask you.
Last night in Richmond, there's only one Confederate monument that's still up, and it's caught up in court. But every night they put a message on it, And just last night, they had just a huge, you know, display of John Lewis that overtook the Confederate statue. And it was just such an amazing, amazing thing in Richmond last night. But go ahead with your question.
And if this is too personal, you can pass on it. But I have a master's in clinical psychology and another master's in psychology, and that's what I'm getting my PhD in, is in psychology. And I know as a therapist what it's like to experience vicarious trauma because of what you hear other people going through.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, is that something that you've experienced being associated with these young men and women who have fallen?
Definitely. I mean, secondary trauma is real, you know. And I think a lot of education is truly, truly starting to embrace that whole secondary trauma thing. I tell new teachers all the time, don't just look at your health plan when you're signing the district contract. Make sure that mental health is a part of whatever school district contract that you sign, because you really need it. And I remember the day. I always remember this day. My wife, she told me, you know, we were sitting around, we were talking about just local news. And she was like, hey, did you hear that it was a 4-year-old that got shot on Southside the other night? And I was like, yeah, that happened. And then I realized, wait a minute, that's not a normal reaction for someone to have that reaction to that news. But then I realized I was holding so much trauma from my kids. They're telling me this, the life story and some of the things they've been through, that I had become numb to the violence of the world. And so that's when I realized I needed to start some therapy. I needed to start talking this out to someone. And that was a really life-changing moment, because, like, you need to start taking this seriously, because you hold on to all this anger, all this, you know, hurt
pain.
From your kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, pain. Because you feel like, I want to do as much as I can to help alleviate that pain. But then you're also limited by what the system allows you to do, and you just hold on to it. And so it's really important that you have an outlet for that pain. I tell teachers all the time, there's nothing wrong with going to therapy. There's nothing wrong sometimes just to have a group of teachers sit around and talk about some of the things you're going through. You need that emotional release, because if not, you'll become jaded. And if you're not the best person you can be, you're going to hurt your relationships with the kids, because you're not going to be there 100%. Or more importantly, it may take a toll on your physical health. And it's really important that you find an outlet for all that secondary trauma that you're dealing with.
Well, you know, I think that too, what you and Maria are saying, Rodney, applies very much to what the country's going through now.
Yeah.
You know, I think we all became indifferent to that systemic racism that we knew was there. But then when we saw what happened what happened with George was George Floyd was just something that brought it all to the surface, because it was such, I mean, we all sat there and watched this indifferent white police officer murder this man on TV.
Full disclosure, I've never watched the full video. I can't.
Yeah, I don't blame you. It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible. And I think that when I first saw it, I didn't understand what was happening until they explained it, you know? And then when they explained it, it just became so horrific to see the indifference on this man's face, and the fact that this poor man was begging for his life and all these cops are standing around doing nothing. And, you know, but I think that what you and Maria are talking about is what the whole country's going through now. Let me ask you, since we're starting to run out of time here, do you have a website for that people can reach out to you, or that can help you in your work that you want to share with us?
Yeah, RodRobinsonRVA.com. Rod Robinson RVA. That's also my Twitter and Instagram, Rod Robinson RVA. And so it's just really about, you know, of course it's about branding, of course, but it's also, you know, all tons of information, you know, speeches that I've given. That speech I gave in front of Betsy DeVos that I was talking about is on there. of course, it was recorded somewhere else because media was banned from my ceremony. I was the first National Teacher of the Year to have media banned. for my ceremony.
But
and you can contact me, you can send me messages, you know, I'll respond, you know, and it's really just, you know, promotion, you know, promote the work that I'm doing. And if you want to help, because I often say, we don't do this alone. There are a lot, that's one thing I've learned as I travel as teacher of the year, there are a lot of folks willing to reach out and willing to help. And so it's really important that everybody understands that it's not just the teacher's job to teach, it's the entire community, from business owners to politicians to school board members to local politicians. Everybody has a stake in education. And so anytime someone comes to the table and wants to have a conversation, I'm willing to have that conversation as long as it's rooted in what's best for our kids.
Let me ask you, this is a compulsory question on our show. Do you teach your kids anything in Virginia about the fact that the people of District Columbia don't have a voting member of Congress? Do you teach them anything? Is there anything in the curriculum that talks about the fact that we have 705,000 disenfranchised people in the district, including 325,000 African Americans?
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because when we went to the CDC every year, they always stop by the booth about D.C. And if it, you know, they signed up, they get the emails. They're fully active, you know, because they understand that people in Washington, D.C. need representation. You know, they need to be a state. And so it's a really important issue. And plus, it's Richmond. The vast majority of my kids have relatives in D.C. And so it's really an issue that strikes home to them. And especially when we talk about representation, and they're like, I don't get it. Why do they not have this representation? And I mean, you know what it really became an issue to them? Once Washington, D.C. legalized marijuana, because, I mean, let's be honest, they're kids. They're going to be interested in those types of issues.
Right.
But then once it got tied up into, why can't you buy it? And that was an opportunity. To me as a teacher, if I see an opportunity to teach something, I'm going to jump on it. And so it really got us into the whole, why did the people vote for something, but yet it wasn't, the laws didn't express their will. And so it really got us into a deep discussion about D.C. And they, trust me, they're really upset that D.C. can't do what they want. And to them, it started off kind of as a marijuana issue, but really it became a citizens' rights issue. And we had that conversation about D.C. We had that conversation about Puerto Rico. And we have all that conversation about what is true representation. What does our Constitution promise people versus what is our government deliver?
Well, when you become governor, after I get you elected governor, I'm going to come and lobby you. Thank you so much, Rodney Robinson, Teacher of the Year. I think you're an amazing person, and I think you're doing amazing work. And we so appreciate you being on our show. Maria, do you have anything else you want to add?
I do. Would you just repeat your website once again? Because it's important. I think you are so inspirational. If people can reach out to you and vice versa, there might be some synergy that we are able to create from your time on our program.
Yes, it's Rod Robinson, RVA, as in Richmond, Virginia, .com. That's Rod Robinson, RVA.com.
Okay. Thank you for that. And you and your wife are both educators.
Yes.
It must be stimulating conversation at home.
Honestly, we limit our education conversation to 1 hour. You know, and that's just for our mental health. It's like we can talk about other things, but for an hour, we can come home, we can decompress, we can talk about our kids. And if we need to talk more, we talk more. But a lot of times, it's just about decompressing, and it's really, okay, we get an hour to talk about our day, then let's just talk about some other things going on in our life, because, you know, we're teachers, but at the same time, we do have lives. And if we let teaching overrun that, then that's going to overrun our relationship. So we really have to set those boundaries.
Nice.
Well, that just shows how smart you are.
Exactly.
And I hope you'll come back sometime in the future. And tell us, you know, after we get things rolling again, so you can tell us how it's going. But thank you so much for being on. We'll talk to you again soon.
Congratulations, too.
Congratulations, yes. And we always leave you with the song, folks. And I couldn't think of a better one than this old rock and roll favorite of mine. I saw this guy perform live with a snake in North Carolina when I was a kid. Here's one from Alice Cooper. School's out. We'll see you next week.
Your turn.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.